you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So glad to have you with us today. Hope your day's off to a good start. A warm one here in Southern California. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, we'll discuss President Biden's congressional address last night and talk about his American Families Plan, the cost of it, what's contained in it, the taxes that he's proposing. We'll get into that in depth on the program and also talk today about the proposed ban on menthol cigarettes. The FDA is looking at trying to implement that ban. We'll hear the pros and cons of that coming up later on the show. But first, another public health issue, COVID-19. And joining us, as he does regularly, from UCLA School of Public Health, epidemiologist and professor of medicine, Dr. Timothy Brewer, one of our tremendous experts. We are so honored to have with us each day. Dr. Brewer, welcome back.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much. Fully vaccinated now, finally. So that's great. However, we are seeing some resistance on the part of younger Americans to getting vaccinated. And I wonder if you have any thoughts from a public health standpoint on how to make a stronger case to those that are holding out on getting vaccinated.
Well, I think two issues, Larry. The first is that younger individuals, people between the ages of 18 and 34, are really driving ongoing transmission right now. So if you look at California, where we're doing incredibly well, people between the ages of 18 and 49 account for about 60% of all our cases. And nationally, 18 to 34-year-olds are over half of all the cases. So really, we need young people to step up to really stop the transmission of this virus. And the second is we're getting more and more data to show that even people who've had mild COVID disease or asymptomatic COVID disease can have long-term sequelae, including what's known as brain fog or mental fatigue, muscle weakness, and other problems. And so the way to protect yourself from having these long-term health consequences is to get vaccinated to avoid having the disease.
Dr. Brewer, where do we stand on the development of potential boosters? And is it clear that we're going to need booster shots for the vaccines we've got?
Still unclear as to whether we'll need them, though I know that both Pfizer and Moderna are presently working on boosters. What we do know is that there are certain variants, particularly the South African B1351, the Brazil P1, to a lesser extent, the two California variants, where the vaccines still by protective effectiveness, but not at the level that we see for the regular virus or the UK virus, the B117 that's spreading so rapidly around the world.
So could we see something where perhaps people who haven't been vaccinated that decide later they will get an updated version of the vaccine that includes the new formulation, but that people who've received the original version won't necessarily need to have a booster? Is that a possibility?
Certainly a possibility. So it's certainly possible that they'll change the configuration of the vaccines as the virus continues to evolve, but that people who have been previously vaccinated still have enough protection to protect them against serious disease, hospitalization, and death, which is the main health outcomes that we worry about.
We're at 866-893-KPECC. Your questions for Dr. Timothy Brewer, noted epidemiologist, UCLA School of Public Health professor, 866-893-5722. You can ask your question via Twitter at AirTalk. You can post on the AirTalk Facebook page. And of course, as always, you can post on our AirTalk segment page at kpecc.org. Each day, we bring you a noted medical authority to answer answer your questions about COVID-19. And of course, in recent weeks, those questions have largely been about vaccination. 866-893-5722. We're seeing stories that in many of the developing countries of the world, they may not be able to get majorities of their populations vaccinated for up to 2 years. Why would it take so long, particularly once everybody who wants one in developed nations have it? Why would there not be sufficient supply to get it elsewhere in the world?
So it's a twofold problem, Larry. The first problem is actually just the countries that have the vaccine capacity. These include the United States, countries in Europe, primarily also India, which is actually the largest vaccine producer in the world, have banned exports not only of vaccines, but of vaccine supply. So, for example, some of the things that India needs to make vaccines, they actually have to get from the United States, but the United States had temporarily stopped allowing those supplies to leave the country to build up vaccine supply within the United States. So the first problem is we're not doing a very good job of sharing across the world in terms of vaccines and vaccine supplies. And the second is just ramping up production capacity. You're talking about trying to vaccinate almost 8 billion people, and going from 0 to 8 billion does take some time.
Now, the U.S. is sending its supply of AstraZeneca to countries that are in need, but not doing so until it gets its emergency use authorization by the FDA here in the U.S. Why is that necessary if the AstraZeneca vaccine has been approved elsewhere, if another country is willing to take it? Why does U.S. FDA approval, since it wouldn't be for domestic U.S. use, why would that matter at all?
I have no idea. That would be a terrific question to ask the people in the government who are not allowing the vaccine to be released.
All right, 866-893-KPECC. Isabella in Santa Monica said, I have a friend who got the Pfizer vaccine during the clinical trials in the fall, and I'm a little worried she's getting together with her, whether the effectiveness of that vaccine has lasted this long. She'd like to have her friend as a house guest. This sort of raises another question for me, Dr. Brewer, and that is those individuals who were in a clinical trial last year in the fall, are they typically still being followed to see what their level of antibodies are?
So they are, Larry. And so we now have data to show that the vaccines have remained effective for up to 8 months. So that's the farthest out that we have. The plan is to originally follow them for 1 year. And I don't know if that's been extended or not, but they are being followed for at least a year.
All right. So do you know if that information is typically released to the participant in the study? So would this woman who was vaccinated with Pfizer last fall, would she know the last time that she had a blood draw that you know she had antibodies still?
So it depends on the study, and I don't know what they told participants at the time the original study was set up. But in general, at least in the clinical trials that I've been involved in, we don't give people individual results, but we do tell them the overall results of what the study has found.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You can post on the AirTalk Facebook page or tweet at AirTalk Gen of LA. So I've been wondering how officials determine how people are contracting COVID. When people are admitted to the hospital or even when they test positive, do they get asked where or how they think they contracted it? Since contract tracing never became robust, I'm curious how they determine the methods of continuing spread. That's from Jen of LA.
So, Jen, it's actually very difficult, but there are a number of steps that are taken. So one is contact tracing is still going on. That's actually done primarily by the public health department. So it's not done by physicians like myself. It would be the public health department contacting the individuals and letting them know. You can actually get an app on your smartphone which will notify you if you've been in contact with someone who's been diagnosed with COVID-19. So there are electronic ways to try to track that as well.
Dr. Brewer, you know, I think it seems funny to many of us that, you know, here we are with modern day medicine and we still don't have a sense of what's happening any given point of time with the virus. For example, to my knowledge, we don't know what percentage of the drop in cases we can attribute to people who previously had COVID-19 and had antibodies as a result versus those who've been provided protection by the vaccine. That would be important information, I would think, to have. But, you know, why is it that some of these things that, you know, we would think modern day medicine would be able to have available, why that information isn't there?
So it can be very difficult to know if somebody's been infected if they haven't been tested versus how they've been vaccinated. But what you have to realize is so in California as a whole, we've had about 3.6 million cases. We've given out almost 30 million doses of vaccine. So that's not 30 million people who are fully vaccinated, but at least partially protected. So we are actually starting to get towards having more than half of the population having some immunity to this virus. And that's going to slow down transmission. But tracking exactly how a virus moves through a population, especially one that can be spread by asymptomatic individuals, can be extremely difficult to do.
We're talking with Dr. Timothy Brewer at UCLA School of Public Health, where he's professor, noted epidemiologist. Elizabeth in Altadena is a runner, and she has two running groups she's a part of. One of them is a small group of five, the other a group of 200 runners that get together. And she's trying to figure out from the CDC guidelines on masking for fully vaccinated people, if all the runners are fully vaxxed, do they need to mask in either the small or the large group?
So according to the new CDC recommendations, if you're engaged in an outdoor activity and you've been fully vaccinated, then no, you do not need to wear a mask, though the CDC does still recommend avoiding larger groups, and it's a little vague as to what constitutes a larger group and whether 200 would be considered a larger group or not. However, the CDC would also still recommend that you maintain your physical distancing. So if you're running with 200 people, you have to space yourself out 6 feet apart. That's going to be a little more challenging to do than if you're running with four other people.
Say, I'm amazed how quickly people take to new guidelines. When I go out on my walks in the late afternoon or early evening in the neighborhood, you know, everybody had a mask on up until, you know, day before yesterday with the new CDC guidelines. All of a sudden, people are, you know, without their masks, still giving each other distance. But it's remarkable to me how on top of this many Angelenos have stayed with the very latest news. I can't think of anything else that we faced where so many people are so plugged in. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You can share your question for Dr. Brewer, and he'll be glad to answer it for you as he joins us regularly on Air Talk with your questions. You know, one of the questions we get so frequently is about kids who, of course, are not vaccinated because we don't have the testing finished yet on under 16-year-olds, and whether the kids should be masked when they're around people outside the household who have been fully vaccinated, if that's not necessary. What are your thoughts on that, Dr. Brewer?
Right now is that if you're at low risk for COVID-19 disease, you don't need to wear a mask if you're with people who have been fully vaccinated. And that would include most children who do not have underlying health diseases that would make them immunocompromised. So in a household with fully vaccinated people, you don't need to wear a mask. If you're visiting somebody and you're fully vaccinated and they're at low risk, you don't need to wear a mask. So grandparents going to see their grandkids do not need to wear a mask as long as everybody's at low risk for serious COVID disease.
This has to be strange for many, you know, parents who've been so concerned about their kids potentially giving them COVID and been concerned about their kids going back to school with the messaging that it is okay for the kids to be unmasked around people who are fully vaccinated.
Yeah, no, it's been a difficult and trying process for all of us. And one of the challenges has been we've had to learn as we go along. So I don't know if you remember back to our original conversations, Larry, but at those times we were saying, don't wear masks, right?
Yeah,
and then all of a sudden everybody had to wear a mask, and now we're starting to pull back on the mask wearing again. And part of that is just as the pandemic changes and as we acquire knowledge, we learn some of the things we thought were right were wrong, and some of the things we thought were wrong were right. So hopefully we're doing better now than we were at the start of the pandemic.
We'll be back with more with Dr. Timothy Brewer joining us on Air Talk, noted epidemiologist who has served on the advisory boards of the World Health Organization, the National Institutes of Health, and the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Brewer, professor of medicine, UCLA School of Public Health. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Joaquin in the Burbs, writing on the Air Talk page, says it so well. The type of people following CDC guidelines will jump through any hoop they're told to. They were never the ones who needed the guidance in the first place. The ones who need the CDC guidelines are those who are less likely to pay close attention, and those who tune out if the guidelines are needlessly complex and contradictory. That's Joaquin, writing on the Air Talk page at kpecc.org. Stacy in West Los Angeles says, I think we need to have facilities to manufacture vaccines here in the U.S. If we have more federal funding for it, would it make sense for universities to have such facilities? Would it make sense to have them under the supervision of the National Institutes of Health? Dr. Brewer, I know that we do some of that manufacturing here because we had the problems with the plant doing the, was it AstraZeneca? I can't remember.
In
Baltimore, was it?
Yeah. So we do have vaccine facilities, and we have vaccine facilities that are industry-based as well as public health system-based. For example, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health has a vaccine production facility, or at least they used to when I lived in Massachusetts. What you have to recognize is that vaccines are highly regulated business, and so you can't just go out and open up a vaccine plant. The FDA has a lot of stringent criteria to protect vaccines and make sure they're safe. And so it's not easy to open a vaccine facility. It's not like making toilet paper, for example.
Would it make more sense to you, though, to have more of the manufacturing done here, or are the costs of doing it in the U.S. So much higher that there's a downside to doing it domestically?
Well, you know, that's a terrific question to ask someone in the vaccine business, because these are business decisions, right? So Pfizer, a Merck, a Johnson & Johnson, they make decisions as to whether or not they think there's sufficient business to invest in the production capacity to make these vaccines. And it's very expensive to run and manufacture vaccines. So that's a great question to ask them, whether it makes more sense to do that in the US versus somewhere else.
Well, and certainly if you've got a pandemic, the United States could provide additional funding to cover that extra cost to ramp up here in the U.S. We have Catherine in Mar Vista said, I'd like to know what Dr. Brewer thinks about the recent case increase in the Pacific Northwest. Is that a potential threat to California?
So it's COVID anywhere is a threat to have COVID everywhere. So the short answer is yes. In general, California's been doing very well. We're actually with Alabama of all states, about the lowest in the country right now. I think as long as we continue to follow the guidelines and to push vaccination as hard as we've been pushing it, we're probably not going to be at risk from what's happening in the Northwest. Right now, the hot spots in the U.S. are still the upper Midwest and the Northeast primarily.
Ken in Sherman Oaks says, my doctor's recommending Pfizer vaccination because of my underlying conditions, but it's really difficult to find out where that specific vaccine is being given in the San Fernando Valley or Los Angeles. And I was wondering, is there any way of getting that? Ken, I'm only familiar with when you go to make an appointment to sign up that they will typically tell you which vaccine is available at that site. But to do what you're talking about, do a search for a specific vaccine. I don't know how to do that. Dr. Brewer, you have any advice?
No, I don't. That's a terrific question. I would start by contacting either your local county public health department or your provider, because at least they'll know what vaccines they have available. You might consider going to the myturn.ca.gov website as well, which is the California state-based website for vaccine information, and see if they list it out by vaccine type. But I actually haven't tried to do that, so I'm sorry I can't give you more help.
I wonder if another thing might be to call local hospitals because it seems that the largest percentage of the Pfizer vaccine, because of its ultra frozen storage requirements, that was being done largely at health centers and hospitals. So maybe that's another thing you could do is call around if you haven't done that already. Professor, why would a doctor recommend the Pfizer vaccine over Moderna or Johnson and Johnson because of pre-existing conditions?
Unclear. So, in the case of Johnson and Johnson, there have been a few reports of blood clots. So we think we understand the mechanism for these blood clots. It's an antibody response against a platelet factor. Why the Johnson and Johnson and the AstraZeneca vaccine seem to do that more than the Pfizer and the Moderna still is unknown. And why it tends to occur more in women under the age of 50 is still unknown. So the risk in women under 50 is about 7 per million. And the risk in other groups is about 1 per million. So for a woman under the age of 50, everything else being equal, if I had access to all the vaccines, I'd probably give them either Pfizer and Moderna or Moderna rather than Johnson and Johnson. They do have different components to them. So if someone's allergic to polyethylene glycol, which is a stabilizer used in one of the, I forget whether it's Pfizer or Moderna, that might be a reason. But in general, I think they're pretty interchangeable for most people.
All right. Julie writes on the page, are you concerned that some of the drop in COVID cases is just a natural summer fluctuation and that the virus will come back in the fall as it did last year, just at the point we've relaxed all safety protocols?
Certainly, that's something we need to be thinking about as people move outdoors. We do know that respiratory viruses do not spread as well in high temperatures and high humidities, and people are naturally distancing more because they're outside. So I think that's part of it. But hopefully we'll continue to push our vaccination. So come the fall, when we're at higher risk for respiratory viral infections, we have more people protected with vaccines.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Brewer. As always, we appreciate your expertise and joining us. Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us. Oh, we have a listener who says for CVS and Walgreens vaccine appointments, you can actually narrow down to one vaccine when you sign up. So, Christiane, thank you so much. We appreciate you sharing that information with us. Dr. Timothy Brewer, professor of medicine, UCLA School of Public Health, the noted epidemiologist. Always a pleasure to have you with us, sir, on Air Talk.
Thank you.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.